This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. We're speaking with James Corbett, publisher of thecorbettreport.com. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster. He's speaking to us from Japan, where he has worked and lived since 2004, originally from Calgary, and still, I would imagine, a Calgary Flames and Stampeders fan as well.
That is correct. Thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure to be here, Jim.
James, did the sirens wail where you live when the North Koreans fired that missile over Hokkaido Island?
I am a good way away from Hokkaido, so it was not that that concerning for us individually here, but obviously for the nation of Japan, quite a hair-raising moment. For people who don't know, the North Korean government just recently tested another missile, not an intercontinental ballistic missile at this point, but at any rate, they shot one right over our heads here in Japan, and the path followed just, it almost passed over the water area right between the main island of Honshu and the northern island of Hokkaido, but I think it went over a little bit of land. But at any rate, definitely passed directly over Japanese airspace, obviously quite concerning on a number of levels, and it did have its effects on the stock market here. You saw a bit of disruption on the Nikkei index as people got a bit spooked, but it seems to have stabilized. In fact, on Wednesday, the Nikkei stock average actually gained 0.74%, and the Nikkei volatility index, the so-called fear gauge, is around 15, which means that people are not quite losing their heads over this. It's not quite causing panic or mayhem, as it seems that despite the provocations and the tests, the possibility of full-fledged military confrontation between U.S. and North Korea still, in the minds of investors at any rate, remains remote. So, again, it's quite worrying geopolitically, and there's a lot of geopolitical moves, but economically speaking, it looks like investors are not freaking out about it at this point.
Any impact on the yen?
The yen has not been impacted by that at this point. Again, I think the first order effects we would be seeing would be in the stock market. Secondarily, the yen, obviously measured against the dollar, really has more to do with the strength or weakness of the dollar than or the carry trade than it does about the geopolitical move.
Alibaba apparently has found a way to get around Chinese currency controls. How would they do that?
Well, there's a number of different ways that that companies of various sorts or even individuals can get around capital controls, and to a certain extent, one wonders if certain loopholes are built into the system, with nudges and winks from Communist Party officials, who have friends in various places. The other aspect to this that we have to keep in mind is that the official numbers and figures that we get from the Chinese government are always, quite suspicious. And a great example of that actually recently came out from a report from Caixin, where they were looking at the official numbers about the outward direct investment of various Chinese companies, and they found that the real estate ODI had dropped 82% year-on-year in the first half of 2017 against the first half of 2016, which sounds like a dramatic drop in overseas real estate investment, until you dig into the numbers and you find that, in fact, a CBRE report shows that Chinese private firm spending on overseas real estate grew 102% year-on-year over that same time period. So how do the official numbers get it so wrong? Well, one of the things that they do not do is take into account money that is Chinese corporations' money that is already overseas and is being transacted in the overseas markets. So all China is putting into their official figures is what is already in China and going out from China. But that's not all the money that's sloshing around in these Chinese firms' bank accounts. So that's one way that these types of things can be gained. And other things are, for example, the way that sovereign wealth funds are tracked versus state-owned enterprises and the different rules that apply to them. So there's a lot of different ways that companies like Alibaba and others can appear, at any rate, in the official figures to be complying with these kinds of capital controls, but in actuality can be moving around overseas holdings and other things that are outside the purview of these numbers.
Are most major Chinese companies part of the government, or the government's a secret partner?
That would be a good way of putting it. Either it is a directly state-owned enterprise outright, or any conglomerate, any corporation of any significant size in China certainly is there by the tacit admission and cooperation of the Chinese Communist Party. There is no major player in the Chinese economy that is not going to be in some way or other beholden to the Chinese government. And if there are players that step outside of the bounds, of course, they do get raided or shut down or thrown in jail or potentially even executed. So I think every major conglomerate and corporation in China understands that, and that's how business is operated there. And that's why you tend to see these large companies, at the very least, have strong connections to the Chinese Communist Party, if not outright having them as investors or secret investors.
Yes, I've covered extradition hearings from people from China charged with corruption, and I asked what went wrong, and they simply said, we bribed the wrong people.
Yeah.
Is China closing down car factories?
Well, they have. There has been a little bit of brouhaha recently, specifically surrounding Hyundai Motors, which, of course, is a South Korean company. And they have a number of Chinese auto plants. And China has recently moved to close down four of them. And it's interesting. For example, the Beijing Hyundai Motor is a 50-50 joint venture with BAIC, which is a Chinese automaker. And that was closed down. It has since, production has since resumed there, but there was a disruption. And presumably, at least on paper, this is over some non-payment to part suppliers, or something along those lines. But, a lot of people are speculating that this actually might have more to do with geopolitics. Specifically, Beijing trying to bring some pressure to bear on South Korea over the THAAD anti-missile defense system that's just been recently installed in South Korea by the United States as supposedly part of a defense against North Korea, but I think China understands that that missile defense system is really aimed more at China. So there's a lot of speculation going on that this may be part of a kind of under-the-cover geopolitical war that's being waged by economic means via China.
I heard a comment that said, the U.S., Russia, and China all have to speak with a common voice on North Korea. Is that likely to happen?
Even if it does, that might not actually eventuate into anything tangible. Of course, we know that diplomatic language is one thing, and what actually occurs on the ground is another. And I think a good example of that is China's seeming tacit agreement that perhaps was potentially met at the cake summit with Xi and Trump at Mar-a-Lago earlier this year, where they were enjoying some delicious chocolate cake and discussing things like North Korea. And it seemed at that time that perhaps China had agreed to bring some economic pressure to North Korea over their missile program. But the fact tell a different story. In fact, there's an interesting story up on the Nikkei Asian Review about the economic turnaround in North Korea that has enabled it to aggressively pursue its nuclear development and ICBM development programs. Namely, that the North Korean Central Bank is estimating, for whatever that's worth, but it is estimating a GDP growth of 3.9% last year, which whether or not it was actually 3.9%, any sort of growth would be a significant change around from 2015, where there was a 1.1% contraction in the North Korean economy. What is this due to? Primarily infrastructure investment, but also mining of coal and lead. And China is a large buyer of coal from North Korea. So it seems that China has been, if not bringing economic bear to North Korea, perhaps even actually helping to expand the North Korean economy, which of course helps to, in a sense, subsidize their nuclear development program. So again, whatever lip service is paid to bringing some sort of pressure to bear on North Korea, the actual facts on the ground might tell a different story.
Is there any feeling in Asia that President Trump has surrounded himself with too many generals and that it might affect the way the markets react to the U.S. government?
I'm not sure there's that level of granular detail of analysis in the general press here in Asia, but I think that all of the people who are looking at what's developing in the Trump administration right now are quite concerned about the militaristic tone of this. And of course, that goes right from the National Security Advisor to obviously the large input that the Defense Secretary and others have had on, for example, the expansion of operations in Afghanistan. So I think that obviously plays into the Asian situation, and Asian political analysts are well aware of that. And that obviously has, again, some pretty worrying concerns for a lot of people about what kind of impact those military counselors will have on the idea of how to resolve the North Korean situation, because obviously military advisors would be more likely to put military options on the table, which I think is what everyone is trying to avoid at this point.
Have India and China called off their border dispute?
In fact, I don't know what the very latest on that is, but I did see a tweet from China Daily, which I did not check out, but they said that there had been rumors that China was going to be paying some sort of money to the Indian government to basically, you know, back down on the Indian border dispute, and China Daily was calling it fake news. So I'm not sure what the very latest on this is, but for people who don't know, yes, China and India have been having some flare-ups over some remote, quote-unquote, parts of their border areas that don't seem like they should be a major geopolitical sticking point, especially now that China and India are more closely related than ever before through organizations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, sometimes framed as a kind of counter-NATO organization. India and Pakistan both became full-fledged members earlier this year in this security compact with Beijing. So it seems that in one sense, China and India are closer than they've ever been, but at the same time, India has put up a fuss about the Belt and Road Initiative, the Silk Road plan, because it infringes on the Pakistan-India-Kashmir dispute. And also, again, we have border disputes going on directly between China and India now. So it's a very interesting time, and it doesn't look like anything's calming down quite at this moment.
If you look on a map where this conflict is, it is in high mountainous areas where there's nothing but, I guess, snow, ice, rocks, and the occasional Yeti.
It's difficult to even find exactly the history of the area and why it's important and what side is claiming what, because there is a bit of a convoluted history to it. The Diplomat has a podcast out that recently went into it in some degree of detail, talking about the historical nature of the dispute. It's not a simple, you know, open and shut, cut and dry thing that's going on here, and it's not immediately apparent to anyone why there'd be any sort of geopolitical utility to this border area. But this is the way these types of disputes often go. It's not necessarily over the parts of the globe that you would first think about when you think about disputes. And it's strange the way this one has escalated so quickly and not gone away. Again, from outsider's perspective, it might seem that this is such a silly little dispute that it shouldn't be occupying two major powers like this. But in some respects, perhaps this is just a reflection of the fact that China and India, I think, are both respectively very well aware that they are the main competitors for regional dominance and going into the future. India has for a long time, of course, as the world's largest democracy, been touted as a rising, developing economic power that has a lot of potential. But I think they realize that China's designs over really South Asia, Central Asia, Eurasia, the entire space does infringe on India's potential growth. So I think we might be seeing some of that manifesting right now in this border dispute.
James, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you for having me on. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
My guest has been James Corbett, publisher of thecorbettreport.com. He was speaking to us from Japan, where he has worked and lived since 2004.